www.thebrainfarm.com.
This is Chris Evans with another Storage Unpacked podcast. I'm here with Martin. How are you, Martin? You been out today?
I've been out for a walk. I walked past a pub, but I didn't go in.
No, I've not been out either, but we're allowed to now. We're allowed to go and sit inside, which is a big change compared to where we were last week.
Yeah, well, it's time is just about right. The weather's turned really, really bad. So,
yeah, that's true. It has been the classic sunshine and showers, or it's been torrential rain and showers. I don't know what you've had, but it's been pretty awful.
We had hailstorms, so.
Did you? Ah, well, standard UK weather.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right, let's move on and have a chat with somebody who's probably not sitting in somewhere where he's got standard UK weather. We've got Robert Novak with us. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Martin. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. We know each other from Tech Field Day. I'm trying to think the last time I would have seen you in person, because I think you went off into a vendor and then sort of dropped out. But I think it could have been 2016, 15 maybe? I think.
Probably 2014. That's when I went over to the dark side for about 6.5 years.
Okay. Let me stop you there. Why don't you just give everybody an introduction and you can fill in your trip to the dark side as part of that.
Sounds good. Well, I'm Robert Novak. I live in the heart of Silicon Valley, California, USA. I've been here for about half of my life. I was a sysadmin, full stack sysadmin for about 20 something years. I've lost count. The second thing you lose in your old age is the memory. But after about 25 years of being a full stack sysadmin for small companies and large companies, startups and some of the biggest names that anybody on the planet's ever heard of and everything in between, I went over to the dark side. I took a job with a large green company on Tasman Drive in San Jose to be a data center technical solutions architect, working with big data and later on with just general data center compute and networking. So I've been a server guy almost my whole life and got into some of the crypto stuff in 2013. One of my friends was trying to convince me of what Bitcoin meant and that it was going to be really big back in 2013. And I only slightly believed him, so I didn't completely get left in the dust. But I got a slower start and then sort of ramped it up from there. And that's kind of where we ended up with the topic we have today.
And what are you doing now? Are you just a man of leisure?
Leisure, catching up on projects, what we call the honey-do list. Mm-hmm. All the stuff that I should have been doing in the background while I was working full time. Now I don't have as much excuse not to fix the thermostat, not to clean up the yard, maybe replant some grass so it'll die in the next California summer, things like that. Also upgrading and expanding my home lab, catching up on some of what I missed in the last 3 years of cryptocurrency mining, getting a lot of hardware I probably will never get around to and will put up for sale in 5 years and hope it's still worth something. But
we all do that, don't we? Let's face it, we've all got tons of stuff we shouldn't go out and buy, but we keep doing it.
Very true. We all have projects, don't we?
Yeah.
Yep.
Absolutely.
At least it doubles as a test for the shock absorbers on the back of my car.
Yes, good point. Yes. You very quickly touched on what we're going to talk about today. Now, we're not suddenly becoming a cryptocurrency podcast, just like we're not ever going to become a networking podcast or anything else like that, despite the fact that we get emails every week from somebody who tries to invite us to talk to some networking guests. But that's another story. We are, though, going to talk about Chia, the cryptocurrency that's based on storage, hence the reason for us talking about that particularly. Now, Rob, you've got a number of blog posts online where you've obviously dug into this quite early, and we thought it'd be a great opportunity for you to get on, talk about it, and help us understand it. Martin and I talked about it, what, 3 or 4 weeks ago, Martin, and I think you've been very proactive and gone off and built yourself a little bit of a rig to do something, and I've done nothing.
I was going to say, was it 3 or 4 weeks ago? It's probably a couple of weeks ago, actually, Chris. It seems like 3 or 4 weeks ago, but yeah, I've gone and got some old hardware up and had a bit of a play and see what it is. But I'm really excited to speak to Rob because he's actually been looking at this a bit more, and I think he has a bit more understanding about the best way to set it up, what it is, and it'd be really interesting to hear his take on this.
So Rob, we've got a little bit of an agenda here. Why don't we just start with a high level view of what we think crypto actually means and what it is, because I think that's quite useful for people who might be a bit in the dark about exactly what the details are.
Sure. No problem. So usually when you think of cryptocurrency, you think of Bitcoin, you think of possibly Ethereum, Litecoin, Doge lately, but you think of a coin that gets mined. And mining is using compute resources to generate proof of work. basically you're distributing a huge amount of mathematical work across a network. It's almost Hadoop, but running on GPUs or CPUs or ASIC-based computers all around the world. And by mining or doing that processing on your GPUs, which is predominant these days, or ASIC miners, as they do in some countries with very cheap power and lots of free land, or even CPU mining for things like Monero, you're receiving work from the network, you're processing it on your processors, whether it's your AMD or Intel CPU or ARM, even on the new Macs, or on the 2048 CUDA cores on your GPU, or the AMD equivalent of compute units, or the ASICs, which are pretty much similar but out of the reach of most home users. So in those cases, you're using a lot of power, you're generating a lot of work and reporting it back, and if you're lucky, or if you're mining in a pool, you get a certain amount of reward in that coin, or in some cases a related coin, for the work you do, and then you can convert that to what's called fiat currency, or your native national currency. You could change it to pounds, euros, dollars, whatever you happen to find comfortable. So that's been going on since 2010, I think, when Bitcoin started getting mined. And it uses a lot of power. It makes the power utilities very happy. In fact, they're putting in more power at my home now, or near my home, because people are using more energy for things like this, I guess. But it uses a lot of equipment that's effectively specialized. You know, in 5 years, when the Ethereum mining is ancient history, the GPUs I'm using today won't be useful for much of anything. And I will have gotten a lot of use out of them. I will have made my investment back many times over, but they won't be as useful for reuse at that point. ASIC miners, I think, have a 2-year lifespan if you're lucky, before it becomes more expensive to run them than the benefits you get back from them.
Okay, and I guess that's because the longer you mine something and the more that people discover the coins or get rewarded for the coins, the actual amount of work to find the remaining coins becomes more difficult. I don't know whether that becomes exponentially more difficult or linearly more difficult. Is there a way to sort of measure that?
I think it's closer to linear. You can look at the difficulty charts for any particular coin. I was looking at Ethereum. I think it's doubled in network difficulty since January, which means that the GPU mining rig that's in the next room is getting half as much productive work in a given time as it did in January. And it's a fraction of what it was 3 years ago when I set it up. Right. It is still making money. It is still getting work done. It is still building up my Ethereum reserves. But to keep the same share of the network, you have to keep growing. And that's true with pretty much any cryptocurrency, including Chia, which we're going to be talking about more.
I'm kind of interested, I mean, about this. I mean, so Bitcoin, so now we're into Chia. So Chia is a difference. So I'm trying to understand what the difference is. And has it come out of nowhere? How long has it been bubbling under? I looked at their website. They've got some big backers, got some big VCs involved. So do you want to talk about the difference between proof of work as opposed to proof of space, because this is a proof of space. So what's the difference? Why is Chia seen as the greener option?
So you touched on a couple of good points there. We've got proof of work, which is what most of the crypto mining today is. You've got, and that's, you get credit for how much work you put into the network or into your pool. You've got proof of stake, which is what Ethereum is moving to in the next year or two, which means you're no longer focusing on mining. You're focusing on holding value in the network. For example, if you have 32 Ethereum, you can have your own stake. And then in the evolution of the blockchain and the currency, you can make money by holding that, loaning it out, things like that. That's harder to get into. A lot of the people who are doing proof of work are going to move to proof of stake with what they have. But proof of space and time, which is what Chia is, combines two elements. There's the proof of space, which hypothetically it's unused disk space on your equipment that you are representing to the network. You're creating these things called plots. There's a lot of green and farming analogies in the currency itself, and I'll talk about a bit of that as we go along. But you're creating plots on your hard drive. Right now they're 102 gigabyte files, and you're proving that you are investing that space. But there's also a time element, and I'll be honest, I don't understand the full depths of it, but it involves Time Lords, so I love it.
Of course. Yeah, good point.
But there's I think it's a verifiable difference factor. I'm going to bravely switch to my notepad here. I was digging into this real quick. Verifiable delay function. And this Time Lord element of the Chia stack is what goes through that time, and one quick Time Lord on the network creates a new block or introduces a new block in the Chia blockchain. And that can become a reward for somebody who passes certain plots, plot filters and challenges on the network. So the difference here is that it's not as transient as most GPU mining. The work I do at 10 o'clock today on my GPU never matters again. I'll never do the same piece of work again, probably. Whereas in Chia and in some of the proof of space coins that came before it, you create a plot, you do your proof of space, and then you maintain it, in theory, forever. Practically 6 to 10 years until the next size of plot comes out. So in a way, it grows infinitely. But to touch on the green element, you're not burning as much energy to keep those plots going. You know, typical hard drive is, what, 8 to 12 watts? Yeah. Maybe less at idle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A typical GPU, the ones I have that are 3 years old are about 100 watts nonstop 24/7 each. So even with the 60 terabytes of plots that I have, you know, about 600 plots, I'm using less power to keep those online than I'm using to keep eight GPUs running on a rig. And it produces a lot less heat, which if you notice me sweating a little bit here on camera, it's because I had the rig running up until about an hour ago and it raises the temperature 20 degrees. But even my three EMC arrays at home don't raise the room temperature that much. So you're getting a couple of green elements there. You're getting less energy used. You're getting reuse of existing equipment with one caveat and less power draw. But you're also able to reuse equipment that's been retired, you know, lease end, hardware upgrades, refresh cycles, and so forth. So most of the hard drives I have were probably in data centers for startups in Silicon Valley a year ago. They got rid of them because they were outdated. I got them really cheap. I plugged them in. They're storing plots and they're using, you know, 100, 200 watts. So I'm able to keep that out of the landfill, out of the shredder, out of the trash bin, and make some money at it and build on some new applications that are coming out for Chia.
Yeah. Okay. So I think I would look at it and think that as a comparison, proof of work or proof of effort, that proof that says you've done the calculation or you've run lots of complex maths and you've finished executing that and you can prove that you've actually executed it because that's the process that you're actually doing. And whether that generates some sort of super GUID or random number, I don't know how it actually tracks that. I guess that's part of the blockchain process. But at the end of the day, the more technology you've got and the faster you can do that process, the more likely you are to hit onto something where you can actually make some money out of it. The challenge is, though, that that process gets harder and there's no value for doing it once, however long ago. So it's not like if you hit on that 3 years ago, or you did that work 3 years ago, that work has got long-term value. And by storing the data on disk, you're keeping a record of the effort you've done effectively. It's almost like physically proof of the historical work you've done rather than proof of the work at the time. And as a result, you can go back and reuse that. So all these plots that Martin's done, you've actually got some value of holding on to those plots you've already done, Martin, I guess.
Yeah, I've already seen there's a market for people trying to sell plots as well. Mm-hmm. I've already seen that starting to come forward as well. So it seems interesting. It seems that there's going to be a variety of markets for people to actually try and make money out of Chia as well. It seems to diversify things a little bit.
Yeah, there's the hardware resale market. There's plotting for other people. Basically, they give you their public key and their farm key, and you create plots that are only usable by them. When you're plotting on your personal farm, those plots can only be used by somebody who has your keys, your wallet. The 600 plots I have down the road here can only be used with my wallet. But I could set it up to do those plots with your public key or your farm key and then ship them across the ocean to you. And then you could just plug them in, put them on your machine, and they would start going. And the idea in that kind of a marketplace is you pay me for the time and hardware that it takes to do it, since you might not want to have a bunch of really fast SSDs and a couple of hundred cores, and you might not want to wait a month to get your 600 plots built. So that's where that market comes.
So once it's all built and you've done the plotting process, how do you actually convert that into something the way you get the equivalent of, say, what a Bitcoin was, or, you know, how do you get the token that comes from that? How does somebody say, well, you've done that work and that qualifies you as that particular, you know, to earn that?
So you're going to be plotting the plots, and all of these functions can be done on one machine, or you can split them up. There are people who are doing Raspberry Pi harvesters, which are the farming side of the process. But once you have a plot, the harvester sees, oh, you have a plot. I'm going to make that available on the network. And when I receive a challenge from the network, I can apply it to that plot and see how many filters it passes. And if memory serves, you have a 1 in 512 chance of passing a filter or of receiving a reward if you pass a filter. So without doing too much of the math, because it's a day ending in Y, so I don't trust my math, the odds are still very low of getting a reward. There are people who have 500 plus plots and no rewards, but there are people who in their first 10 plots get one or two rewards. But it's still possible, and it's still somewhat random, I would say. The odds of getting a reward on your first plot or on your 1,000th plot. There's no proportional reward for the amount of work. It's the amount of challenges you do against your work. And that will change in the next month or so when Chia pools come out.
So in what way does the challenge come from across the network? How does that actually affect itself, or how does that come about when you say a challenge?
My understanding is that it comes down from the network. So you have a full node on your environment, whether it's 1 or 4 or 10 plotting machines, and it's receiving status of the blockchain through its connections to other full nodes. And my understanding, I may be wrong on this, I honestly got into this mostly for the hardware, and I've kind of caught up on the software and the logic of it behind that. But challenges and filters, I believe, come down through that full node, and your harvesters that are connected to your full node see, oh, I have this work I need to do to check against my existing plots. And they report back up, and you can see on the GUI, or you can see in the command line status, what's going on with the harvester and what it's seeing and what it's reporting back. One thing I'll throw out there just to connect to that, for plotting, you don't have to be connected to the internet. That's purely CPU, memory, and disk. But for farming, for harvesting, for actually doing the challenges and running the risk of earning something, you have to be connected to the internet and connected to at least one or two other nodes on the Chia network.
Okay. So Martin, you said, yeah, how many plots have you created so far?
How many plots have I got? Let me check. At the moment, I have got, I've got 46 plots at the moment.
Okay.
It's interesting. So the GUI gives you some idea about what's going on in the network. Mm-hmm. And it tells you how many exabytes are devoted to this, and it's already a very large number. It's quite frightening. Like, yeah. It's quite a frightening number. 8 exabytes of people's hard drives are devoted to holding these plots. So okay. I'm not sure whether it's just a scheme by the hard disk manufacturers who thought, all right, okay, how do we convince people to buy spinning Rust? and how do we convince people to burn through their SSDs? I'm sure these are both topics we're gonna start talking about. But yeah, and actually I was reading some of the Reddit forums about that. Yeah, there are people who have 500, 600 plots who have not got a Chia yet. They've not made a token yet. Mm-hmm. And then you get somebody says, oh, I put my first two up and I got, and they both hit. It feels a bit like a lottery as well.
It is. And it's really comparable at this point to solo mining a cryptocurrency, where you're not working with anybody else. You're watching the blockchain, you're getting the work, you're submitting the work, and you're finding out if you find a plot. On an Ethereum pool I'm on, we have people who are running a single GPU who find a block. But they might find a block for a standard GPU, you might find a block every 6 months on average. But that's an average, that's not a guarantee, that's not a minimum, that's not a maximum. You might never find a block, which is why most people go through pools. With Chia, it's the same way, but I think people got excited early on and there was no pooling technology yet. So it's all solo farming. And you have that chance of getting 10 or 20 Chia with a very small plot farm. You have a chance of getting absolutely nothing with petabytes of storage filled with plots. So it is a lottery, and it's an ongoing lottery. You don't have to keep buying the tickets. That's one good benefit of it. As Chris mentioned, you've got your 46 plots. Those are good for 6 to 10 years. You might get a reward on one of those in 2025 without doing anything new other than making sure the server doesn't melt down.
Yeah, don't throw that stuff away, Martin. It's going to be valuable.
Well, you never know.
And worst case, you can sell it to the next crypto cult, as it were.
I just did a quick check, just because the number sort of stuck out for me, and I thought I'd better go and double check it. But February 2025, Chris Miller wrote that. Sorry, February 2020, the 25th of February 2020. Chris Miller quoted that in 6 months, Infinidat had deployed an exabyte of capacity to their customers. So 2 exabytes a year in 2020. And you're saying that we've got 8 exabytes?
Yeah, in 2 months. In use?
That's more than Infinidat have shipped to all of their customers since they started.
Oh, yeah, it's huge. And this is all, this is not cold data. This is, it's warm or lukewarm, because it'll be sitting on larger and larger hard drives. We've always asked Chris, what's the future of the hard drive, and what's the future of these 20 terabyte hard drives? I tell you what they are. They're proof of space for cheer or any, whatever comes along next.
Well, let's move on and talk about the hardware side of it, because I've got a little bit of an angle to ask about that in a second. So, and this is one of the things, Rob, I think you were very keen to talk about, the different technologies that you've got out there. And I think this is quite an interesting area. So it sounds to me like hard drives are a great storage place for the data, but is it also the right place to be doing the farming, the original plotting, or should we be doing that on SSDs? What's the IO profile of the data? And also, what sort of server should you put it in? Because I think Martin had an opinion on that before we started recording. He was thinking about doing something different.
So you're right. The spinning hard drives, any speed, just the largest, cheapest you can get, are where you want the plots to land when they are built. And you can plot to spinning hard drives, especially if they're in an array. Some of the one or two of the top plotters in the Chia community, there's a spreadsheet out there of their machines. And one of them is using a 24-drive, 2.5-inch drive EMC array that's just connected to a SAS card, and they're plotting into that. But the reason that plotting is a little bit more complicated, and the reason that we get into talk about burning out drives, is that the plotting process writes between 1.6 and 1.8 terabytes of data through its 4 cycles or phases to end up creating a 100-gigabyte file that lands on the slow drive and stays there for 6 to 10 years.
So let's just say those numbers again. So how much are you writing in total?
You're writing 1.6 to 1.8 terabytes.
Okay, to get?
To get a 100 gigabyte output file.
So that's between 14 and 16 times amplification.
Yep. And that 1.6 terabytes of writing is 1.6 terabytes of wear on the drives that you're writing it to. And with SSDs, you've got the concept of terabytes written or total bytes written. And a lot of people are learning to talk about petabytes written, because let's say you've got a standard consumer NVMe SSD that's got a 400 terabyte write cycle or write endurance lifespan. That's about 220 plots that you can do on that before you start losing capacity and performance. Obviously, the TBW isn't a firm drive shuts itself off at this point, but that's the point where you should start expecting to see reduction capacity, reduction in over-provisioning, even reduction in performance.
Here's an interesting thought that springs to mind with that. Probably one of my most popular posts on my website, believe it or not, is one that talks about terabyte writes per day and device writes per day. Mm-hmm. And it's suddenly starting to get about 2 or 3 times the number of hits that it used to. And it just suddenly dawned on me, I wonder whether this is people looking to find out which is the best device to do writing of this sort of data. Because clearly, you know, it's a massive impact, isn't it?
Definitely. And I can tell you, I have one of the cheapest 2 terabyte NVMe SSDs that I could find. Well, the cheapest I could find in my desktop at home. And I've gone through about 70% of its life, according to Crystal Disk Info.
So do you know what type of data it is? I mean, is it completely random, uncompressible, all that sort of stuff? Is it that type of data? Do we know exactly what it looks like?
We can find out very easily, but I don't know off the top of my head. It's a series of tables of data that get recomputed and compressed, retabulated, reorganized. That's the different phases. And you do the computation, you do a resort, I believe it is the second phase, and then you compress, and then you move into the final format. I may have gotten phases 2 and 3 backwards, but I haven't gotten around to trying compressing any of them. But it's something that could be interesting. They're saying that they might be able to reduce the write volume of the plot process by 50% at some point in the future. But right now they're working on other things like resumable plots, because right now if your 12-hour plot gets interrupted, say they shut off the mains to your computer room like they did for me, you start anything over. There's no resume there. And the developers are working on that. They're also working on getting pools out as soon as they possibly can so that people will stop asking them when pools come out.
Yeah.
But after that, I think they're going to look at improving, enhancing the plot process, reducing the speed, reducing the write amplification.
Okay, so I've got a question, Martin. I mean, the first thing I look at when I see this sort of thing is, okay, it's between 1.4 and 1.6 terabytes written, but I don't know how much capacity you need to have. But I don't see why you can't create an emulated drive, like an in-memory drive. Bear in mind, you lose all of this stuff if the power goes. Why not just create a virtual drive in memory or use some of the other software tools to do that? And then when the plot's finished, you push it all to hard drive when you're finished. Surely this seems to be like an obvious way to do it.
You absolutely could, but you would need a lot of memory. So you could run a RAM drive. I mean, and I have seen some discussions about that. You could run, remember you're going to need, this is about, let's call it 250 gigs per plot. It's not, but it's, and it has reduced over time, actually. We know it has reduced for the temporary space. So that's how much space you need. So yes, a big server, and I'd be really interested. I haven't seen anything about this yet, Rob, about people who are running it in memory to see what the speed up is. Is there a significant speed up running in memory? What is the determining factor of how fast you can plot?
So you're right. There are a couple of conversations on the Chia subreddit and people who have gotten 384 gig and built a RAM disk that will hold the 256 gig or so required for a plot. And I believe the one that I saw that was most recent, they brought their plot time down from about 6 hours to 5.5 at the cost of not being able to do parallel plots. Because yeah. I have an Intel NUC at home that plots 8 plots in parallel on a good day. To do that in RAM, I would need at least 1.5 terabytes of RAM online, plus whatever my OS needed and so forth. And the cost in doing that, even with third gen Xeon processors, is still a little bit exorbitant.
And I was going to say, actually, your power costs are going to go through the roof as well, because RAM is not exactly the most power friendly. So it stops going from Chia is the green cryptocurrency to being something which you can heat a very large house with.
Yep. If you're looking at 20 watts per dim in the high density, the 32 and 64 gig dims versus 3 to 5 watts, I think, for a typical NVMe drive. Even if you're doing 4 on a bifurcation card, which I'm doing in my 2 main plotters, that's under 50 watts, which would be 2 or 3 dims out of that 128 that you need to get the in-memory plotting. So while memory is important, while the disk speed is important, there's still a lot going on in RAM and in the CPU.
Okay. I hate to try and keep pushing the point, but I'm going to keep pushing the point because I'm sure that we've got to find a device that somehow could do this. And I've just gone back and looked at a post I did a couple of years ago, actually. Yeah, 2.5 years ago, Western Digital had this DRAM caching thing, the UltraStar DCME200, which came in 1, 2, and 4 terabyte capacities. Now, the interesting thing is that I'm guessing that the way it worked was it created a virtual memory pool. So basically, you've got physical memory that you've actually got on the machine, and you've got extended memory, a bit like, multiple virtual storage, funny enough, Martin, the old mainframe way of doing things. And somehow it determines that pages are not being actively used and it moves them back and forth. Again, it's going to come down to the algorithm about whether that's going to be practical to use in a sense to try and beat this. Because if the algorithm is clever enough to realize that that's going on, then you're going to get defeated by the Chia algorithm while you try and be clever about the way you manage that memory pool of physical memory and extended memory.
I think that's right. And I think we see some of that on some of the NVMe modules that use TLC or QLC for the bulk of the storage and some MLC front-end cache, where for a typical desktop or even a server write profile, that's really useful. That really cuts the cost and keeps the performance there. But when you're consistently driving that same 256 gig worth of data 6 or 7 times in a period of 6 to 12 hours, you're going to either hit the limits of that cache or it's just going to give up and not use it.
So which vendors can we go and tap up to see how this should work? Because I'm thinking that this is sounding like an AI type of workload where the same stuff gets churned and churned and churned repeatedly. It sounds like it's something that we should be tapping up vast data for, a system to try out and see how we can get this to work. Or maybe Pure Storage with their FlashBlade and get them to do it for us, because surely somebody's going to do this at some point. Somebody's going to look at it and go, do you know, we can just put in one massive storage box and we'll make this work properly.
Yeah, well, I can see there's going to be people coming up with storage devices aimed at chia mining. That's what's going to happen. We're going to see it. And I've already seen interesting impacts on the Amazon in the UK. It's very hard to get a large hard drive at the moment. So the USB hard drives, you know, the 10, 12 terabytes things, they're going into constraint in the UK. I imagine it's probably going to happen in the US as well.
Already is, yes.
So, I mean, that's an interesting area, and I think we should maybe touch on that next and just talk about that whole idea of the reuse of technology, because typically we did it two years ago, Martin, where you bought a drive online and you managed to find tons and tons of data on it. So,
yeah. You
know, somebody hadn't wiped it properly. But clearly, there's an awful lot of old tech out there. A lot of vendors are taking stuff out of data centers, like you said at the very beginning, Rob, you know, the way that you got some of your tech in the past. There's a lot of old hardware out in the marketplace. Is it a good thing that we're reusing it, or is it not a good thing? I'm still not sure it's going to be as good as or as green as we think compared to, say, you know, mining with GPUs.
I had this conversation in the form of an argument a few days ago on my Telegram channel, and it isn't a perfect green solution. Number one, a lot of that hardware that's been in a data center for 3 to 5 years is going to fail. But I think that it's a collateral green element. In addition to the reduction in power you're using, those are drives that are going to get reused rather than having to make that many new ones. There are still going to be people who will go to Best Buy or London Drugs or wherever and buy or try to buy a new drive or 10 drives or 100 drives. There's going to be people with bots running against Amazon or other marketplaces trying to get all the new stuff because 3 years of the lifespan of that hard drive is already gone if it's been in a data center for 3 years. But is that 3 years out of 10? Is that 3 years out of 4? I have to kind of think about that a little bit. And I found there are a lot of, on the more consumable part of it, the SSDs, I picked up a bunch of Micron PCIe flash cards, like kind of the Fusion IO form factor.
Yeah.
And they get sold to me as used or open box. I plug them in. I look at the driver display. It says one power on, 2 hours use. And it's like it took me that long to get it going. So I have a brand new drive here that was sold as used that's 6 years old, but it has 9 or 18 petabytes of write cycle to it. And $120 for 1.4 terabytes with 18 petabytes of write. That's better than a sharp stick in the eye.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I've tried both ways, so yeah. I definitely prefer it. I think the green element there that I would talk about, that I would promote, would be just reducing landfills and piles of drives in warehouses. It's still going to there's still going to be more drives built, more drives sold, more drives shipped around. But I think there's an incremental greenness to it that's even beyond the power and the limited life cycle of GPUs.
Okay. I can see two scenarios here. First of all of the devices that are already out there in people's data centers that you could reuse, it's a sunk cost and it's a sunk set of resources that have already been used, either to manufacture it or to actually, for the physical manufacture as well as the actual, you know, the energy to manufacture that drive. So it's already built in, that's mm-hmm. already been done, and it's already been done because somebody else did it for a different reason, which is fair enough. That makes me wonder whether there's ways here to optimize. If you're building rigs of old drives and somehow decide to spin them down a little bit and try and think of a way to optimize the power that they use a bit more like a tape drive, or maybe you could use a tape drive, you know, could because what do you need to do in order to farm something once it's been plotted? You know, do you scan the whole drive, or do you just go to an index that says, give me that block and prove that you had it? Because if you can start putting that stuff onto something like a tape, can you then archive all of your plots eventually over time and just call them back as you need them?
My understanding is that there is an index that's built in phase 3, phase 4, that then has to go out to the disk. But the main reason I wouldn't go with tape, and you know, we both know several people who love tape, is that on most tape drives, you can't get data back in 30 seconds. And the current estimate is that you need to be able to report back your results in 30 seconds from receiving the work.
Okay.
Much like in proof of work, you get a block to work on and you want to get it back. You want to get your work reported back in milliseconds. So you don't want to have that delay of spinning up your GPUs and trying to do the work, or spinning up your tape. you may find, if you have the right optimization and some of those high memory boxes, that you can cache some of the storage. Okay. Now, the biggest box that I've ever touched was a machine that would handle 6 terabytes of RAM. That's 60 plots. So it doesn't scale at a one-to-one level, but you might find that if you're doing the same work against the same plots, that you can cache. And there was a concept back when my last stint in the outside world called MADE that talked about spinning down drives in a RAID array or a RAID-like array when they weren't being used. And it might be that a technology like that comes back up.
Yeah, it was a total failure because, well, first of all, because the company who bought that, to build that technology that was mainly out there, built systems that were so heavy that the floors that they put them on couldn't withstand it. So we looked at one where I was and we realized that it was so dense it was impossible to put on any of the floors that we have. And I think the other problem was it used to only spin up 25% of the drives. Well, I never could work out how you'd implement something like RAID in that situation to protect your data, because you need a certain percentage of the drives to be up. You know, am I getting it wrong, Martin?
No, you're not. There's always been an issue with MADE. MADE's often sold as being very power efficient. And I have asked a number of MADE manufacturers, okay, so, but are there events which could cause you to spin up every drive? And actually, there probably are. And as soon as you do that, your data center blows up because you've sized it for 25% of the power on your drives. But I think there are probably some interesting uses with things like our whole favorite, Chris, HSM.
Yeah.
Tiering. Depending how the tier process works, if it's just the first, if the index is just held in the first few blocks to start with, and it asks that question, you could just ask that. And then when it's got it, it can potentially start pulling it back. Now, tape is a bad use case for this, Chris, because these blocks are too small. They're 100 gigs. And it sounds very strange talking about 100 gigs being not very big, but it's not very big. And when we're talking about big LTO drives, if your block was which you wanted, which had been put off to tape, was right at the end of your 15 terabyte tape, for instance, or whatever it is, you're going to be waiting some time for that as it tries to find it.
Of course.
But there may be some options where you can do some clever stuff with spin down drives, and maybe an SSD or something like that, which has the initial blocks, so you're stubbing it somehow. I could see that coming.
Yeah.
Not quite sure how the whole process works at the moment.
Well, to add to that, I was just wondering whether what we might see is people building specific pieces of hardware. So rather than relying on just putting it into an old PC or, you know, whatever, they build rigs of drives that they then, you know, you could front end it with any particular protocol, but then they somehow then spin those drives down, you know, with some proprietary stuff they build. It's not going to be that hard to do because it's a pretty simple instruction to spin the drive down. But as long as you know what you've got to spin back up again, you know, you could spin a load of stuff down and you'd be good. So I suppose there's an option that if this is genuinely going to be worth money, people might start investing in building bespoke pieces of technology to make it work.
The other thing which we have seen and just went away was the concept of the intelligent hard drive, which had processors on the hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
So you had your 4, 8-core ARM CPU, and mate, if you can get a 4 gigs of DRAM of some sort on that, each one of those could be a plotter. It will be slow, but you could have thousands of them or hundreds of them, and it will just chug along. I have seen this conversation online of people using Raspberry Pis as their plotters because they don't want to wear their SSDs out, so they're just having, they reckon they'll get a block every 72 hours, but you end up with hundreds of these. But maybe that's what you do, you build yourself an array with ARM intelligent hard drives.
I mean, do we know what the ratio is? I mean, are we meant to be building big CPU based machines, tons of memory? Do we need a fast processor? Do we need more parallel processing? You know, do you have any idea what you think the best architecture is?
There's a sort of a proportion, what I would call a building block for a plot. And this is one of the reasons that a lot of people don't stick with the Raspberry Pis. They stick with them for farming. There's a great tweet from Bram Cohen from January showing a 96 terabyte farm running on a Rock Pi, which is a slightly upgraded Raspberry Pi. And this was before mainnet came live. But going back to the blocks of, or the units of plotting, you want 2 threads of a CPU, a fairly modern CPU. I wouldn't do a Core 2 Duo. I wouldn't do Athlon X2, but anything from the last 10 years is probably good, and some of the Xeons from before that. 2 CPU threads, 4 gig of RAM. You can allocate almost any amount of RAM to each plot, but The most optimized level is just short of 4 gigs, and anything over about 7 gig is wasted on the plot. It rarely goes over 6, so if you assign 6750 megabytes, you'll never use it all. And then that 256 gigabytes of fast storage, whether it's a wide RAID stripe or an SSD, NVMe, PCIe flash, anything like that. So whatever you can get in units of that block, so 2 threads, 4 gig, 256 gig of SSD, is going to be the best thing to work with. I have a machine right now, a Dell T7910 workstation. It's got 56 threads, 128 gig of RAM, and 6 terabytes, if memory serves, 6 terabytes of SSD. And I can run, I think, 26 plots in parallel, so I can get about 60 plots a day out of it with them staggered with some of the tools that are out there. Mm-hmm. So you can, you know, they tell you start with what you have. So if you have a Ryzen 5 3600, 12 cores, 32 gig of RAM, and a second SSD in it, that's what I started with. And it was great. I learned how it worked. I got some plots going. I did some tuning. I figured out how long plots take and how to offset them. And then I was able to go up to my environment today that does 60 plots in parallel across 5 machines.
Okay, so here's a really stupid question. Protection of the data that you farm into the plots that you create. What are people doing? I mean, do we back it up? Is that even a concept to back it up like that? Or, you know, do you need to put this on protected storage in case the drive dies? And what happens if the drive dies? Do you lose all that work?
So not a stupid question at all. Definitely a question more people should be asking than are. But a lot of people are considering the plots expendable, which means they're using a striped disk, writing everything to it, not backing it up, no resilience. I have a 5-drive, 48 terabyte array at home. And if one of those disks dies, I lose up to 48 terabytes. I'm working on optimizing this a bit. Mm-hmm. I have another machine that I back up to my Synology NAS, which is using large 5400 RPM drives and has resilience against one drive loss with SHR. The thing that I would recommend to most people would be to do RAID 5. RAID 6 maybe, SHR, RAID Z. Something that gives you at least one drive resilience. There is that write hit. It is definitely there. It's definitely a thing. But you're writing to the disk once. Every byte or every 100 gigabytes you write it once serially, which, if memory serves, that's a great case for RAID 5. Yeah. You know, if you're pouring 100 gigabytes onto the drive once and never writing that section again, the initial hit isn't as bad as it could be. And when you're reading, you don't notice it. And you're going to be reading that thousands and thousands of times after the one write. So if you do something like that, it does. Some people are saying, well, I have a 8-drive array. And if I do RAID 5, I lose 10 terabytes. And my response is, well, if you don't and you lose one drive, you lose 96 terabytes. Yeah. You be the judge. In a big sense, that's do as I say, not as I do, because not all of my stuff right now is adequately protected or was even adequately planned out. I've sort of been learning, figuring out how to get the spokes in the bike wheel as I'm riding it down the hill at full speed. But that's part of the fun of absolutely. This industry, is you can do that.
I guess, you know, that is part of the fun, Martin, that not everybody's going to do it the way they should do that. You know, just because everybody's in there doing it, there'll be people who will forget that they'll get bored with it and they'll just stop and they'll, you know, do something else. And so it's not like everybody's super efficient in this. You know, there's still options to come in and get involved, I guess.
Yeah, as Rob said, it's also a chance to get use some old hardware. You mean, Rob, you were talking about backing it up to a NAS. Well, it doesn't have to be the latest, greatest NAS. You can pick up an 8-bay Synology a generation back, as long as it's protected, as long as it will do RAID 5 or RAID 6. You don't particularly care. So you're talking about, so I've got my old gaming machine, which is a X99 chipset, so it's got a Haswell Ian. And it's got a 6-core processor in, so 12 threads. But I thought I'd have a look up, see what I could pick up from a broker. So I've got a much larger Xeon now. But it's cost me £80. So, and suddenly I'm massively increasing my threads. So, and that's the interesting thing. You start looking at what you can get out of the enterprise market, the used enterprise market. There are some bargains out there. There are some things which are rapidly going into constraint. I know you were on your blogs, you talk about the 320s and the 420Ms, the old the Micron cards, which are EMC rebranded, which are rated for a large amount. You can't get them now. people have suddenly realised that. But I've got one which I picked up ages ago, and I actually looked in. It was still sitting on 100% lifetime because people bought them, tried them, didn't get very much out of them. But they're rated to 5-6 petabytes of a rewrite, and you may find you get
9 to 18.
Yeah, you may find you may find you get more. We do know that's the case. I mean, I remember 4 or 5 years ago, one of the consumer sites looked at SSDs and actually saw that some of the SSDs you get a lot more of terabytes written than you'd expect before you start to fail. But it, like the whole chair, it is a bit of a lottery. It's not guaranteed.
It's the oversubscription that they built into that device when they built it. That they weren't, whether they were happy or not happy about their algorithms and their ability to deliver the guarantee. But you've just reminded me, I've got a 420M sitting around that I'm not even using. And literally, I took it out of a server in the lab, and I've got another server in the lab that's powered off. Which now I'm going to be thinking, I'm going to go and power that back on and put that in and see how it performs, because that's probably a perfect starting point for me to give that a go.
Yeah. And it is only PCIe 2.0 X4, I believe. You know, it was a 2013 era card, as I recall. But that's going to be more than enough, and it's not going to wear out anytime soon. So it's definitely good. I picked up 4 of the 1400s, 1.3 terabytes usable. And I put them in my X79 box that had 4 PCIe slots in it and striped them. So I had like 5.6 terabytes of space. That'll do almost 20 plots in parallel if you've got the threads and the RAM.
Yeah. So it's all about...
And it's just crazy.
It comes back to, as with everything, it's all about the horsepower you've got. But you've just got to know what the horsepower specifically is. It's not just, let's put the biggest processor in this time, which I guess is the whole point of why they've done what they've done.
Yep. And, you know, if you stack a couple of 10th gen i7 NUCs that are about $600 each, if you were going to buy a new outfit, those will scale. They're about 40 watts each. Put an NVMe drive, put a boot SSD, hang an external USB drive. And, you know, it's got the spouse acceptance factor because you can't hear it. You can barely see it. So yeah, you can do that pretty easily. And I did that on my blog a week or two ago.
I think
or you can use your enterprise gear that you've had around for a while.
I think if you look at Martin's study there, I think he could hide anything in there without anybody knowing what was in it. Nobody else is going to know that, Martin, because obviously we're not on video. But
That's true. At the moment, I can see 16 Raspberry Pis. So
I've got 16 powered on around the corner there, which I need to do something with as well. Yeah. But yes, I think we've all got a massive collection of equipment one way or another. Could do something with. So one final area that suddenly dawns on me, and I think could be an interesting one, is why is nobody doing this in the public cloud? Because, you know, unlimited compute resources, unlimited storage, surely that's the place if it's cost effective to go off and do it. So is anybody doing that?
Yes, I would say they are. I've heard of a couple of people doing this. It's more likely to be productive in a hosting facility where you have dedicated hardware, because you are really driving the cores, the RAM, and the storage. And not all cloud providers, the big ones do, but not all cloud providers provide a platform that's designed for 100% utilization. You know, you've got that almost mandatory over-provisioning because most people don't use anywhere near what they're expecting to use. But the hosted providers, there are people who are working in Azure and AWS and trying to work in Google Compute as well. One of the problems that may come up there is that if you ever want to move your plots off of a public cloud provider, you're paying through the wazoo for egress and at 100 gigabytes a plot. And if in 2 months you can get 100 terabytes of plots, it's pretty much 100% locked in.
Here's a point, Martin. FinOps. Can you imagine how easy it would be to bury your little Chia mining organization within somebody's AWS bill, when you can't work out the fact that there's an extra few VMs there and a few hundred terabytes of extra storage capacity? I bet people are doing something like that.
Well, probably, but I suspect you could probably hide it in most on-premises some data centers as well.
Yeah.
Let's be honest about this. Yeah. You could hide it. You could spread probably a dozen VMs, small VMs with 4 gigs, and then just start pulling them off and then work out it's your plotting time, and then you just exfiltrate them just by starting pulling it off onto external drives up on your laptop. Yeah. It'd be interesting. I'm wondering how many people are thinking, why has our utilization just gone up?
There's got to be that.
It'd be very interesting. I think there's going to be some interesting proof of concepts kicking around.
Absolutely.
One thing you did say, Chris, was when you were talking about cloud, very interesting, Amit, about you don't necessarily want to run your plots off the cloud, but you might back them up into the cloud.
That would make sense, wouldn't it? Because at the end of the day, it's easy to get it in there, and you're only going to be pulling back what you need if you lost a drive or something like that. So you'd only have to pull back the basic amount. That would be definitely useful.
Yeah, but I think there might be some online backup providers that are in for a bit of a shock when they suddenly see that people are backing up 200-300 terabytes of data into their environments.
Yeah, as Rob said, he was mentioning earlier that people have used other sorts of the free technology. Rob, you thought that was a scenario where people might have tried it and then got caught.
Yeah, you have to remember you're looking at 100 gig files, and most of the online backup providers and online storage providers aren't expecting even a single 100 gigabyte file. The one that I use, I think, maxes at 25 gig per file. So on the one hand, you may not be able to back up your plots to your backup provider or your file share provider. And number two, they may notice a little bit faster than your data center does or your public cloud provider does, and they may shut you off for violation of terms of service. So I'm not a lawyer, but definitely look at the terms of service and think what's the worst that could happen. Because if you get caught putting 100 terabytes somewhere that 100 terabytes shouldn't be, the worst that could happen might happen.
Yep.
And it could be a resume generating event in some cases. Yep,
absolutely. Okay. Do you know, that's been a fantastic hour, fantastic conversation for an hour, Rob. Really, really interesting. You've got some blog posts you've actually already written on this. So can you point us to those so that people can go and find them online? And obviously we'll put this link in our show notes as well.
Sure. So my blog is RISTS11.com, which I'm sure both of you two recognize the name.
Yep.
It's RSTS, Resource Sharing, Time Sharing. And if you go to RISTS11.com/crypto, you'll find the 8 related blog posts, including 5 about Chia. And for a technology I had never heard of 2 months ago, having 5 blog posts, including one that's now the most popular on my blog in 10 years and change, is a little bit shocking, but people have found it useful, and I hope our listeners will as well.
Fantastic. Well, it's been really good to have the conversation. I think sooner rather than later, once we've got a bit more idea of what the hell we're doing, we should all come back and have another chat about it, because it's been really fascinating. But for now, Rob, thanks for your time, and it's been great to catch up.
Thank you. I look forward to the next time.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.